On this week's 51%, it was the inaugural year for an engineering camp for girls.
So they're really learning the process of think, design, develop, test, and rethink, which is very, very important to start at a younger age.
A mother who lost a daughter to childhood cancer dedicates her time to helping others. We hear about theater therapy for recovering from addiction and bring you an historical look at friendships between men and women. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
When a theory emerges consistent with the facts, the proof is with science, the truth is with science.
Science is real.
Kids are back in school, and some high school girls in New York's Hudson Valley are bringing with them a week-long summer experience from engineering camp. I spent a few hours with the girls one day as they worked on a project at the camp's host, the State University of New York at New Paltz in Ulster County.
We're designing a prosthetic leg out of cardboard and PVC tubing and duct tape.
Hard?
A little. It takes... It takes designing and thinking and I guess a lot of troubleshooting, per se.
That's Francesca Lowe, an incoming junior at John Jay High School in Wappinger Central School District. She and 10 other high school girls, as Lowe mentioned, were building prosthetic legs after having toured a company based in Ulster County.
So we visited Rifton Equipment, which is the local company that makes medical assistive equipment for physically disabled people, people with cerebral palsy, who are not able to kind of hold themselves up. And it was a wonderful tour. It showed the girls the process of making parts from the start to the end, the process of thinking and creating, being very creative, and problem solving, which is very, very important as a skill set for engineers. So they're really learning the process of think, design, develop, test, and rethink, which is very, very important to start at a younger age.
And that's Rena Dolly, assistant professor with the Division of Engineering Programs at the State University of New York at New Paltz. She was overseeing a week-long camp for girls at the college called Tinker Camp, designed to engage high school girls in engineering, inform them about different disciplines within engineering, and show them what engineers do. That day, the camp's focus was on biomedical engineering.
The great thing is about half of them want to come back next summer to do the camp again, so that to me is a sign of success. Watching them do the project today after starting the first day, they're doing a lot of thinking first before building. They're asking more questions. I want them to become more curious about things around them, to ask how things work and why they work. I see excitement and curiosity, and I've already had two girls tell me that they're interested in biomedical engineering and thinking of researching it. To me, that's success in a camp.
Lowe is one who is interested in the field.
I came here to figure out if I wanted to really go into the field of engineering, because I was always thinking of doing that. I just wasn't sure what I was getting into in the beginning. But I really like it. I think I'll go like more into it, possibly. Possibly do more research on the field.
Jessica Rattray from New Windsor is homeschooled. She was collaborating with Lowe on the prosthetic leg and had a positive take on the camp.
Well, I think it's great. I think it'll give me an opportunity for engineering because I really like math and physics, so that's a job that involves lots of that. So, you know, I want to become a biomedical engineer because I also like helping people improving the quality of life and incorporating math and physics and also chemistry and biology into that.
Jasmine Schiffer is going into ninth grade at Ellenville High School.
I like it. I mean, I was originally forced to be here by my parents because they're techies and they're like, oh, this is cool, you should do it. And so I was like, engineering, okay. But, you know, I like it more than I thought I did, and, you know, I'm getting a kick out of it.
Dolly says three female engineering undergraduates at SUNY Buffalo designed the program. She approached them at a Women in Engineering conference, offering to have SUNY New Paltz serve as the pilot campus for the program, with the idea of eventually rolling it out SUNY-wide. In addition to piloting the camp, Dolly founded an organization 3 years ago on campus focusing on women in engineering.
So if you look at our current student population in the engineering program at SUNY New Paltz, it ranges between 8 to 11%, the female population to the total population. So there's work to be done. We've actually started a group here on campus. I've founded a student group called Women in Science and Engineering. It's called WISE. And we started off with 8 members, and now we're at 95 members.
And it's a few WISE women who are running the camp. At the helm is WISE president Lori Jockers, a senior majoring in mechanical engineering.
At first, they were very, like, shy and quiet and, like, very nervous about the camp. But through, like, team bonding activities, we started seeing them work together and get excited about these projects and offer their ideas. And they didn't really know much about engineering in the beginning, but now I'm sure they could tell you about 5 different types of engineering in the fields.
She says the all-girl atmosphere of Tinker Camp and WISE is important to boost confidence.
I was an art major at first when I came here, and it was all women, and there was only 2 boys in my class. And I felt like I was good at art, I was very confident in myself, and then I came here, and I was one of, like, 2 other girls in my class, and I kind of shied back and everything. But Rena actually introduced me into WISE, and I just felt like the confidence there just boosted back up, and I'm really grateful for that.
Morgan Ketchum is entering her junior year at Pinebush High School. She appreciated the teamwork in constructing the prosthetic leg.
Well, it's easier with a team. If we were by ourselves, I think it would be a lot harder, and I think the team here would agree with me.
Mm-hmm. And how do you like working with a team?
It's nice to collaborate all of our ideas together, to be able to work together. It's a good thing.
She adds,
well, I'm interested in biomedical engineering and pursuing a career as a biomedical engineer. So to be able to experience this as a 16-year-old, it's nice for me. And I'm looking forward to coming back next year.
Gabby Mills is starting Saugerties High School.
I was interested in engineering because if you are an engineer, like, there's so many paths for you. You can be building bridges or making prosthetics or so many different opportunities, and I think that's really cool. And I think it would be really good for me to kind of see more of the opportunities I have.
You want to, like, put, like, cardboard there and just, like, set
I think it. We just need to put on more tape, but that's all it needs. It's just weak.
More tape, and then
that's
just
the whole,
like,
problem. It's because we broke it, and then we had to fix it.
And then just, like, tape around the cardboard so that we, like, keeps that.
Yeah, that's all
together.
We need to do. Okay, so let's take this off.
This should be the maximum it should be able to bend.
This week, we bring you another installment of the 51% segment called Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg. She is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in Napa Valley, California, and she blogs for the Huffington Post. This week, Ufberg interviews Annie Malloy Gould, who has served on the National Board of Directors of Cure Search for Children's Cancer since January of 2014. She has taken on this cause in memory of her daughter Eloise, who passed away in 2010 from rhabdomyosarcoma, a rare childhood cancer. Her dedication to this cause is all in the hope of improving children's lives. Cure Search for Children's Cancer supports targeted and innovative children's cancer research and is a source of information for those affected by children's cancer.
Why take on such a prominent role for something that's so personal?
Well, plain and simple, being a mother to a child of cancer that didn't make it was my inspiration. There was no master plan to getting to where I am today. In retrospect, I realized I just couldn't walk away from something that has so impacted me, my family, and friends throughout the world.
I think that it's so, you know, important for people to understand the impact that the work is having that you do with Cure Search, and perhaps you have a story or two to share that would reflect that.
Well, one of the things that I realized after Eloise passed away is that, you know, there were many people that wanted to do something. And I, of course, in my state of mind, wasn't sure if I could, but I was certainly encouraged by many. I attended a Cure Search walk several months after her death with the accompaniment of my family. And I was moved to see the surviving children on the stage receiving a medal that's sort of honoring them as having gone through treatment. So I was determined to do something in my hometown, or in my actual hometown, Charlottesville, Virginia. And in 4 months' time, I was able to put together a walk. We had 400 attendees, raised $75,000. And I sent some photographs to another mother whose child had been diagnosed at a very early age, and this was really only 6 months into his treatment. And I sent the pictures to her, and just really happy to share them, very pleased with what we had accomplished. And she wrote me back, and she said, "This was the best day of our lives since the day my son was diagnosed." And I looked at that sentence, and I thought, this is all I need to just go right on ahead. And it really inspired me. And this mother inspired me. We are still in touch. Her son is a survivor of neuroblastoma. So, you know, there are some good stories that do come out of this work. And that for me was just, it was just so early on. It was just a really wonderful beam of light. I mean, and I knew I had taken a leap of faith in something that I just firmly believe in, and I continue to believe in it more and more.
Well, it seems that, you know, your ability to share your positive experience with the CureSearch fundraising walk was a way to really reach out to someone who did need some support and some help. Do you have some current statistics of how many kids are affected by childhood cancers?
I actually do, and it's on our website, so it's really quite straightforward. I'm going to read almost verbatim for kind of how they have sort of illustrated what is the current status. Every day, 43 children are diagnosed with cancer. 12% of those children will not survive. Mm-hmm. I've always kept it in mind that childhood cancer, it affects all ethnic, gender, and socioeconomic groups. And so we're not isolating this to any particular cause. It's just it's a situation. It's current. And when you look at the big picture of these numbers, on average, I believe it's still pretty steady. 40,000 children a year are undergoing treatment in one stage or another, or one phase or another. And you know, I look at
40,000. You said
yes.
Wow.
And I looked at all of that, and it is numbers, but it's children. It's children. And I have a surviving daughter, and I have nieces. I have nephews. Eloise has, you know, her friends. This just has to sort of change. I mean, we are seeing some steps in the right direction, but when you think of 12% of children that are diagnosed, you know, because of the particular types of cancer that may not, like my daughter's, receive as good a response, we have to push the small stone up the hill. It's the reality. It's a reality.
So is your ultimate goal for CureSearch to find the cures for children cancer so that no children die from cancer? Is that the big goal?
Yes.
For CureSearch?
Yes. Yes.
So
yes.
What are some of the things that you are doing now supporting this cause that can help, you know, move the dial on some of these statistics?
Well, as a board member, we meet in person twice a year, and we do conference calls twice a year. We have a very active board, some of which are directly impacted by having a child with cancer. Others are involved with the pharmaceuticals. Others are involved in the business community that, you know, want to do something, want to give back. We have on our website, we speak of our scientific advisory council. It speaks of the different projects in which we support. We support short-term, smaller programs. We support larger incentives. And, yes, I mean, we have to push the dial that way. So that is my role on the board is very important, and I serve as an advocate, and I've taken on this in whatever direction it is, meeting families who are currently involved, communities who want to support something like this. So I believe we will see a difference. I've seen a difference since I became involved in after her death in 2010, and that would be 5 to 6 years. So I have seen a difference, even if it's just having more conversations about it. This cannot go away. I couldn't walk away. I think a lot of people are feeling more like that as they read about it. And hearing the success stories is wonderful. You know, that's what pushes us, but we would like to see more success.
I know that you do some very specific fundraising types of things like the walks. I know you can tell us about, I know you have a hike and there's certain special times of year that childhood cancer is highlighted.
Yes. September is Childhood Cancer Awareness Month, although every day of the year should be, you know, some level of awareness. And CureSearch has 27 walks throughout the country, and they are in cities in which families can gather and honor the children who are impacted by cancer, all of that. I have personally chaired 4 of the Charlottesville walks. I now have 2 wonderful women who are co-chairing that, one of which is the woman I mentioned earlier whose son is now doing well with neuroblastoma. We're getting ready to have our 6th walk in October. On the CureSearch website, there's a calendar of events. There's also a program called The Ultimate Hike, and I did the first one last year in Dolly South, West Virginia. They have now added another one on. So there's a total of 5 hikes. They are also on the website, and they encompass many cities. The one that I'm going to be doing in West Virginia has 5 major cities that are basically on sort of the mid-Atlantic coast. So we'll have about 60 people that will walk. On average, we raise $150,000. And it's a weekend that's really very special. I mean, you make friends through this community. And then people can set up certain events that they want to do. But those are the 2 sort of main components that I've been most directly involved. But there are other fundraisers and things like that that are illustrated on that. And we also have a survivorship program, which they have events in 3 major cities throughout the year, and that's really special to see these young adults now, most of which are young adults, or they're, you know, anywhere from even 20 years out of treatment, will gather, and that's a really huge number. The survivorship number is a really huge one, because that's what we want. We want survivors.
Well, Anne Malloy-Glood, thank you so much for all your hard work on behalf of all the people that have been affected every year by children's cancer. And this is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
The disease of addiction has strikingly high relapse rates, and addiction specialists are looking for better tools for long-term recovery. One researcher in Indianapolis is trying out a new idea. Could acting in a play be a key to staying sober? Reporter Jill Sheridan from Side Effects Public Media has the story.
It's standing room only at a small studio theater on the campus of the University of Indianapolis. Leslie Butler is playing the role of Weaver Arachne in the original play Altered, an adaptation of Ovid's Metamorphoses.
And to find oneself in an art form is perfection.
The play's cast includes characters from Greek and Roman mythology. 6 of the 7 people on stage are in recovery from addiction and are participating in the show as a form of therapy. Butler has been in recovery from alcohol addiction since 2011 and finds acting helps her focus.
A part of recovery for me is having purpose and structure throughout my daily life to keep me busy and keep me engaged.
Dr. Sally Wasmuth is running the production as a research project. She's an assistant professor at the University of Indianapolis School of Occupational Therapy and has been studying addiction for the past decade. Her theory is that focusing on performing a play could replace the consuming quality of the disease of addiction.
I think a lot of times in drug addiction, a lot of participation in meaningful activities go by the wayside. So this is kind of a jump start to having something that you show up for.
The participants commit to 6 weeks of rehearsal, 3 hours a day, 3 times a week. Wasmuth says preparing for a play this rigorously can help battle addiction at a neurobiological level.
Chronic drug use really reinforces reward pathways in the brain, and that doing things like executive tasks like memorization and anything that really involves a lot of attention can also help reverse some of those pathways.
To recruit actors, Wasmuth partnered with an Indianapolis recovery center. She's staged plays before with recovering veterans. She details that project in the American Journal of Occupational Therapy and showed that 86% of the participants in those plays were abstinent for 6 weeks following the performance. Dean Babcock is an addiction specialist at Eskenazi Health. He echoes the importance of accountability in recovery.
Showing up regularly for rehearsals, creating a situation where other people count on you to do a part that affects them, creates this sense of self-accountability. In many ways, it's how group therapy works, is you become a member of a group, and you have a beholdenness to the other members of the group.
Babcock says seeing people with addiction on stage as actors mastering a role can help break the stigma of the disease.
You know, sometimes people view addiction as being, these are kind of scumbags, and you know, these are less than desirable human beings. And what we know about addiction is it affects anybody in all classes, any race, any socioeconomic status, and it's real everyday people. It is your neighbors. It is your family members.
Back at the University of Indianapolis, after the performance of Altered, the audience and cast engage in a talk-back session about the play. Leslie Butler tells the audience why this experience has been meaningful in her recovery.
A lot of us feel a lot of shame for having this disease. And I think projects like this are educating the population, and I'm just glad that I can be a part of it.
Butler is considering trying out for other community theater groups. Jill Sheridan, Side Effects Public Media.
And this story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a news collaborative covering public health. There's a perennial question in romantic comedies, novels, and even self-help books. Can men and women ever be just friends? One Virginia scholar argues that, in fact, American men and women have maintained close friendships since our country's founding. Allison Quantz has the story.
As a college student digging through archives, Cassandra Good thought she had uncovered something big.
I was reading a bunch of letters that had been published by a woman named Margaret Bayard Smith.
Margaret was known to be a close friend of Thomas Jefferson's.
When he was leaving Washington in March 1809, Margaret writes a letter to her sister describing going to the White House to say goodbye to him. Quote, "When I saw our dear and venerable Mr. Jefferson, my heart beat. When he saw me, he advanced from the crowd, took my hand affectionately, and held it 5 or 6 minutes. When I first saw this at 20 or 21, I thought, oh, I have discovered an affair."
Now an historian and the associate editor of the papers of James Monroe at the University of Mary Washington, Good knows better. She's learned to speak the language of early America, and she says that Jefferson and Margaret Bayard Smith were only friends. In fact, Jefferson had close friendships with many women, including Abigail Adams, the wife of John Adams.
They have a lot of common interests. They go to plays together. They both enjoy music. I think intellectually they were well matched. The letters are, you know, witty, affectionate, playful, in ways that we might not expect.
While Jefferson was also friends with John, he and Abigail had their own distinct relationship. After the two founding fathers parted ways over warring presidential campaigns, Abigail maintained her friendship with Jefferson for several years longer.
Finally, Abigail has had it with the personal attacks from Jefferson's camp on her husband, and she stops being friends with him as well.
Which brings up an interesting point. Good says that friendships between men and women were more egalitarian than other relationships available to women at the time.
Part of what we can see in these letters, too, is that women are able to push back if they're not happy with how they're being treated. If a man does something a woman doesn't like in a friendship, she can leave. She can break off the relationship, and we see that happen. Unlike in a marriage or a family relationship where you're kind of stuck with the person, divorce is not something that's easy to get then. And the man actually legally owns the woman in a marriage in this period.
The rules of how to go about being friends were tricky, though. Good found one letter of a man unsure about how to address his female friend.
He opens the letter without any "dear so-and-so." You know, usually we'd see "dear madam" or "dear Elizabeth," "dear Mrs. Bonaparte," something like this at the beginning of a letter. And he just goes right in and says, "I am quite at a loss to know how you would receive any one of these forms, and therefore I have rejected them all and written none." He's saying, "I don't know the proper way to do this." He doesn't know the proper way because, in fact, there are all these guides to letter writing in the period that tell you how to write a letter to a business partner, how to write a letter to a father when you've been a bad son, like really specific letters, but no model letters between friends of the opposite sex.
Today's pop culture also seems to be searching for models of how men and women can be friends. Of course, those models do exist, and they go back much further than many of us would expect. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quantz.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1416.